Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Thanks for tuning in to this week's presentation of our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, October is packed with activities and important events, so we're going to use this last program of September to begin telling you about some of them. In our first segment, we're going to visit with the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services to talk about Domestic Violence Awareness Month events, including the 19th annual Sound of Hope gathering on October 3rd in New Haven and the Umbrella's annual Candlelight Vigil on the evening of October 9th in Shelton. October is also SIDS Awareness Month, and October 15th is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day. So we're going to be speaking with Allison Jacobson of First Candle, a national nonprofit based right here in Connecticut that's committed to eliminating SIDS and other sleep-related infant deaths. And we're going to close reminding listeners about the thousands of Connecticut friends and neighbors coping with lupus and invite you to support the Lupus Foundation of America's advocacy and research by participating in the October 14th Walk to End Lupus Now that's happening in Norwalk. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. Hey, you want to have some fun? Newtown Parks and Recreation is partnering with the Newtown Chamber of Commerce, presenting the first Newtown Day community event on Saturday, October 6th from 11 to 5 at Fairfield Hills, just off of Route 84 at Exit 11. Organizers are promising plenty of food, fun, and festivities for kids of all ages to enjoy. Admission is just $3 for adults, $1 for children 6 to 12, and kids 5 years and younger are free. The event will feature loads of food trucks, food vendors, pop-up shops, family activities, inflatables, and entertainment from local bands. Adults can also enjoy local IPAs, wine, and cider served in the beer garden from noon until 4:30. For news and details, hit the Newtown Day event page on Facebook and Instagram or visit newtownday.com. Well, we're back in the Naugatuck Valley once again at one of the longest and really most cherished of the nonprofits that we have been working with for virtually all of the 28 years that I've been involved here on the award-winning For the People. We are talking about the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services, or as we've come to call it, Umbrella in the Valley. The center is a program now of BH Care that provides services for victims of children of domestic violence and other victims of domestic violence free of charge. Each year, over 6,000 abused women and their children walk through the door here at the Umbrella looking for shelter, help, and hope. And we are so pleased to be talking to their director, Esperina Stubblefield. There's a couple of really important events coming up, and we're going to tell you about those in just a few minutes. But first, Esperina, thanks for having us. We wanted to talk a little bit about some of the reasons why you do the things that you do and some of the most exciting new news that's happening here at the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services. And I guess the first is kind of on the heels of a program that we did with another regional Family Justice Center. Now the Umbrella is going to be doing that. Tell us a little bit about that program.
So we're looking at, first of all, thank you for having me. We're looking to open, it would be the second Family Justice Center in the state of Connecticut. It's to have a place where victims can come and get services in all under one umbrella. Right now, they have to travel from places to places. Sometimes we did a study where sometimes it could take up to 5 days for somebody to get service. When we open next year, somebody will be able to come to one place and be able to see a prosecutor, be able to see the police if they wish, be able to see counseling services. So we're really excited to be able to provide the services, and it's recognized by the federal government as the best model to provide services.
So is this kind of location staffed daily so that they can immediately respond to each person that may arrive as needed? Or does it just
put someone who may come to the umbrella in crisis on a Tuesday into a situation where maybe, you know, on Wednesday or Thursday, they could go to the Family Justice Center and see all of the necessary representatives?
So the goal is to provide services every day whenever we open to an individual. Mm. So we have some partners that are, they are full-time in some part-time, but the key partners will be there full-time. For example, an advocate that would be able to advocate for them, give them counseling. If somebody walks through the door, they'll go through a short intake and be able to see a counselor right there and be guided through the process. On site, we would have lawyers there if they need some guidance in terms of services. We will have child care available. We will have a children room, mm-hmm. so they won't have to worry about where to leave their children to come for services. So it's all right there. It's not about coming back for appointment, because if they have to keep on coming back for appointment, what would be different than the system what we have now than the new one? So,
well, I can imagine it's one thing when it's all umbrella or BH care staff who are going to be available to victims every day that you're open. But the coordination of the outside parties like the police and the judicial and perhaps the other crisis intervention parties or the attorneys, I imagine that's the heavy lifting.
That could be some challenging. That's why we have a coordinator that would be their sole job to really coordinate the relationships, making sure that we are communicating internally, we're meeting, and making sure that we are filling in the gaps wherever they might be. There will be some key people, their umbrella people and partners that are not, they may have somebody that's there pretty much all day on some days, but the services will be key. Even if it's not umbrella, the partners will be. That's the committee. Others sign an MOU saying that I will be there 20 hours, I'll be there 10 hours. Yeah. So there is an agreement. It's not maybe I might show up.
Excellent.
Because it's important that we provide the victims with comprehensive services.
Sure. And it's most important also to, I imagine, preserve the case and interview evidence and to ensure that the victim is not interfered with by the perpetrator in the time, you know, for the difference between seeing somebody and getting immediate help within hours of a situation versus days. I mean, that could be a life and death thing.
Absolutely, it can. So through the LAP program, and individuals are able to call us. So the police officers put them in contact with our program right away at the scene of a crime. Yeah. So that individual, let's say if it's happened last night, the next morning they will speak to a staff tonight. They might go to court tomorrow if that's the situation, or they might want to come to the office to see a staff member before anything could happen, depending on what the situation was.
Yeah. Regular listeners will recall a number of programs we've done with either the Connecticut Coalition or various regional agencies, Milford Rape Crisis and such. The LAP program that you're referring to is a Lethality Assessment Initiative that all Connecticut law enforcement agencies now engage in, where if they go through a multi-point questionnaire with the victim and they check enough boxes, They automatically, literally hand them a phone where they could be contacting their crisis intervention specialist right on the spot. And since we're here and we're talking about it, how do you find that the LAP program is doing in terms of hastening the availability of services for these victims? Do you find that it's working well?
It is working well right now. All of our we cover 19 towns.
Yes.
All of our towns are involved with the LAP program. We find that a lot of victims are not happy, but they know that somebody's there. They don't have to call a number the next day. The police officers, when they screen in high lethality, putting them in contact with us right away, whether the, if they want to talk to us, they have that option, and we could safety plan with them right away, or even be able to tell them what's going to happen when they go to court the next day. They don't have to go blindly not knowing what's going to happen. So if, and if they want shelter, we can help them right there, or if they need whatever other assistant might come up, we could help guide them through the process. It's very important. I think it was a missing element, and I'm so happy now all of Connecticut is participating.
Yeah, and I think it really helps law enforcement expand their level of both involvement and expertise to the victim. Police department's buy-in to the care and support of the victim, I think, is much greater and potentially more empathetic now because of the LAP program. So that's great. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're having a chat with Esperina Stubblefield. She's the director of the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services, which, as you heard, serves many towns, kind of an L-shaped pattern from Brantford up and through the New Haven Orange area and then up the Naugatuck Valley. Many communities benefiting from this organization. Before we tell you about the upcoming vigil to honor survivors and remember victims of domestic violence, and a couple of other activities that are coming up in October, early October, actually, one in New Haven and then another one in Shelton. We want to talk about another activity that's happening, and that is the case management program that the Umbrella for Domestic Violence Services is engaged in right now. Oh, okay. I will mention that. Good. So case management program is in place now and beginning to work, but this is relatively new for Umbrella.
It's a relatively new program. Working with Office of Victim Services, we have a grant where we're able to provide long-term case management for victims of domestic violence. This program allows us to go into the home if it's proven to be something that the individual want and it's safe. We are able to go to the individual's house and do case management with them and court accompaniment. And as we do within every other services, all the services we can provide in their home. They don't have to come to the office necessarily to get those services.
Excellent. Well, as we mentioned, there's a few events coming up in October. So the final one is October 25th.
October 25th.
And that is, so we'll start sort of at the end of the month and work our way back to these two vigils that are happening. What's going on October 25th?
October 25th, we're having our kickoff event for the Family Justice Center.
Oh,
and that's happening in New Haven. And we are just finalizing some key things. So more to come on that. We're very excited to have this kickoff. It's a kickoff fundraising event.
Oh, so it's most important for folks who are listening, who may be interested in supporting the second in the state, a Family Justice Center, to save the date of October 25th and stay tuned for more information, or continue listening to our program and we'll obviously have an announcement about it in one of the programs prior to October 25th. But sooner than that, to raise awareness about domestic violence, BH Cares Umbrella Center is holding an event to honor survivors and remember victims of domestic violence. This is the to honor the survivors and remember victims of domestic violence. This is their annual candlelight vigil, an extremely important and very, very emotional and highly comforting and uniting for everyone who participates. In my experience, going back now to 20 years easily, that this event has been going on and off. So this one is coming up on October 9th, and it's on the Huntington Center Green in Shelton. So not in downtown Shelton, but up in Huntington Center. So very easily accessible, kind of off Route 8 and off the Parkway. So give us a little lowdown on that, Esperina.
So on that day, we really want to invite people to really come out, and survivors, families, and friends to support those that have been a victim. It's a very important moment for folks that are feel like they are not alone. There are other people that are survivors. And also there is a program out there that supports them in whatever decision that they may be in. It might be the decision might be not to leave the relationship because it's not safe. It's a highly threatening situation. Mm-hmm. But to know that there are folks that are out there, there are programs out there, and that they're really not alone. And remember the survivors, the people that are. That managed to get out and managed to move on from the relationship and how they are flourishing now.
Mm. And since October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, activities involving the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence start nice and early in the month on Wednesday, October 3rd. This is an afternoon event at 1 p.m., and it's called the 19th Annual Sound of Hope. That event obviously would not be an effective candlelight event, Esperina, but tell us about that.
So this one is a bit different. It's at Long Wharf Pier, where we again honor victims of domestic violence. You have a lot of people that work with victims, families again that show up, and we also recognize the police officers both events actually. Mm. We recognize the police officers that were nominated by their peers or as someone who made a difference in the life of a survivor. So we recognize those. And we have a procession down the pier, and it's led by a bagpiper. It's really a solemn moment. And we have opening. We have great speakers usually at the event, and we throw a flower in the sound in remembrance of those. And we also read the name of the victims from the previous year, every year.
Mm. And I see it looks like almost two dozen law enforcement officers are going to be honored at this event. So I know we have a lot of folks in the law enforcement community that listen to this program, and we would invite all of them to the 1 p.m. event on October 3rd at the Long Wharf Pier in New Haven, the 19th Annual Sound of Hope event to honor these law enforcement and to begin all of the activities for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. But before we leave, we want to talk about supporting domestic violence services 365 days a year. Many of those days reflect times when the My Sister's Place, which is a thrift shop that has been supporting Umbrella forever, since I can remember, now you can support the Umbrella through My Sister's Place in the comfort of your own pajamas in front of your computer or tablet. So before we go, Esperina, tell us how the new website is doing at supportforumbrella.org.
Supportforumbrella.org, it's a website. It's the first of its kind. It's a thrift store where the benefits goes to a domestic violence agency. Yeah. So we're very excited about that because we are in the Valley. Oftentimes folks say, I want to support, but I'm not able to come to the Valley because the hours, the work, whatnot. But from the comfort of their home, as you said, people can go and place an order and see the nice things that are there. Yesterday we had some wonderful baskets that went like crazy, hotcakes, if you will, folks had. They are great items. They'll be things that with tags on them a lot of times. Yeah, so folks can definitely go and purchase event. All the proceeds goes to the Umbrella for the two shelters that we run and the court services that we're able to staff and, and the court counseling service that we provide during the day. As you said before, we serve over 6,000 individuals, and it's not a one-time service. Some of those people, they come in time and time again to be able to be guided out of the situation that they find themselves in.
Yeah, and we also know sometimes, unfortunately, the parties involved cause the court cases to be dragged out for months, sometimes years. Mm-hmm. And all this time, the victims and sometimes many children in the family need support, shelter, assistance, mm-hmm. Professional intervention, counseling. It's critical work that the Umbrella has been doing here in the Nautic Valley and now expanding its expertise all the way up the shoreline into Brantford for so many years. For most importantly, before we leave you, Esperina, we want to remind people, if you need domestic violence assistance, you can call 24 hours toll-free from any phone, 888-774-2900, or more easy to remember, 211 for info line. Of course, if you are being victimized, call 911 and speak to your law enforcement source. Right now in the state of Connecticut, we also have 911 texting available if you need to be quiet about your call for help. And if you want to learn more or shop and support My Sister's Place in the Umbrella program, you go to supportforumbrella.org. And for more information about the vigil and domestic violence services and the Candlelight event here in the Valley, you go to bhcare.org. So we want to thank Esperina Stubblefield here at Umbrella in Ansonia for having us and the great work. And we once again remind people to come out to the Candlelight Vigil on the Huntington Center Green on October 9th and this wonderful Sound of Hope event on the Long Wharf Pier in New Haven at 1 p.m. October 3rd to honor all of the partners in law enforcement who have done such an exceptional job in assisting and intervening in domestic violence incidents here in Connecticut and Southern Connecticut this year. So, Esperina, thank you for having me, and we'll see you at the event.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, we've been waiting a while to talk to our new friend, Allison Jacobson, but we want to remind you here on this last broadcast of the month of September that October is SIDS Awareness Month, and October 15th is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day. So we're going to talk with Allison, who is CEO of First Candle, a national nonprofit based here in Connecticut that's committed to eliminating SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and other sleep-related infant deaths through education while providing support for grieving families who've suffered a loss. So, Allison, great to get you on the air after chatting and emailing with you for about a month now. And thank you so much for doggedly pursuing this opportunity, because it's something that we haven't talked about enough on our program here, and I'm glad you're able to spend some time on this midpoint segment to educate us and tell us about the great work that First Candle is doing. First of all, though, give us your backstory and tell us where your passion for finding and running this organization comes from.
Sure. Well, I've been aware of First Candle for over 21 years now, and that's because in 1997, my first child died of sudden infant death syndrome. He was 3 months and 24 days old. He was at daycare. He was, for all apparent ways, completely healthy. We had no indication. And I have to tell you, John, that's what's so difficult about this. There are really no answers to SIDS. And it's something that just really changes you for life. So I sat on the board of directors for First Candle for several years and then went on to have other children. And I was fortunate to get called by First Candle 2 years ago asking if I wanted to come in and run the organization. And I felt like my life had come full circle at that point. I felt like this is where I'm meant to be, because unfortunately, SIDS is still the leading cause of death for babies 1 month to 1 year of age. There's over 3,500 babies that die every year. And you're right, so many people don't know about this. And I feel like if I can just even educate one person at a time, and if I can help save one baby's life, I'll have done something in honor of my son.
Well, I know that about 2 decades ago, there was a real
bubble of interest when the whole kind of, baby sleeping on the back. That was just after my son was born. I recall there being a huge amount of media on this, a little bit of the standard divergence of thought on the matter. But this was a benchmark when that campaign started, because it did have a huge effect in terms of reducing the amount of SIDS deaths, right?
That's right. I mean, with the Back to Sleep campaign, we saw a 50% decrease in the rate of SIDS. It went from about annually 7,000 a year to down to 3,500. But here's the problem, John, and what was interesting is, as we were seeing the rate of SIDS decrease, the rate of infant mortality stayed the same. So we started looking into what's really happening. Well, the challenge was, there wasn't always proper death scene investigations done when there was a death. And what I mean was, it wasn't looked at closely where the baby was found, what the environment was, what environment was around. And what we have seen is the rate of accidental suffocation has increased by 115% in the past decade. And that's because we are now doing better death scene investigations. So we're realizing what we did with the Back to Sleep campaign was great, but we now needed to take it to the next level. So the government, the AAP, came out with new guidelines, and we are now doing what is the Safe to Sleep campaign. It's almost like Back to Sleep 2.0. And what the new guidelines state is that babies should share a room with mom and dad for up to the first year, but not a bed, have their own safe sleep surface, be it a crib or a bassinet, right near mom and dad, and nothing in that crib. No blankets, no pillows, no stuffed animals, no fluffy bumpers. And that in and of itself can decrease the risk of accidental suffocation and SIDS by another 50%.
And as you're saying that, I'm envisioning people in the car with the radio or the program playing in their home, or them listening on the podcast, and many eyes rolling and jaws dropping. Like, how could you deprive a child of a fluffy blanket or the bumpers that might keep them from hitting themselves or getting their arms stuck in the slats on the crib? But it sounds like that doesn't have to be, they don't have to be deprived of stuffed animals and fluffy blankets all the time. They're perfectly capable of sleeping healthy without them, though.
Right. And well, they should have them when they're not sleeping. And that's the key. What the problem is, and I'm in the media, but we have a problem with all of the adorable images of what a baby's sleep environment looks like. And unfortunately, that's not what it should be. And we think that having blankets and pillows and stuffed animals in there is cozy, but for the baby, it's not. What needs to be in there is nothing but the baby on a firm mattress with a tight-fitting sheet. And the more we can make that the norm and the image that is the norm, it will translate to a more safe sleep environment. Now, I should say, absolutely, when possible, bring that baby into bed to nurse, to breastfeed, but when you're done, put the baby back in their own environment. So absolutely bring the baby to bed to nurse, but when you're done, if you're drowsy, put the baby back in. Now, listen, the one common denominator every new parent has is exhaustion. We're all tired. And, I'm here to say, look, everybody's had that time where they've fallen asleep with the baby in bed with them or on the couch. It happens. And what we're saying, and the AAP says, is have a plan, right? So when you're going to sleep, before you're ready to go to sleep, have a plan of either setting an alarm to wake you up after you're done nursing, or your spouse can wake you up, or something where you can remember and be told to sleep awake, to put that baby back into the safe sleep environment.
Right. You think with all the all the electronic devices and reminders we have for
things that are so much more mundane. You know, there are certainly many tools at the ready for parents to utilize to, you know, wake them up if they fall asleep when they are in proximity to their sleeping baby.
Exactly.
Folks, if you're just tuning in with us, we're talking with Allison Jacobson, who is CEO of First Candle, which interestingly kind of represents the first candle on the birthday cake and her efforts and the efforts of her organization to help reduce the incidence of sleep-related deaths and sudden infant death syndrome in children before their first year. So, Allison, before we take a break, let's just go back to your experience in 1997 and the loss of Connor, your child. When that occurred, what was the level of resource that was available to you? I understand you immersed yourself after that in information to try to both, you know, kind of come to grips with your own personal situation, but try to do what you can to prevent it from happening to other moms.
Exactly. And you know, keep in mind, in 1997, there was no Facebook, and there were no online resources per se. But, you know, when you suffer a loss like this, you want an answer. And unfortunately, with SIDS, there usually isn't. So I started, you know, just trying to find resources, and I ran across First Candle. And I did find bereavement support services. There was parents in Connecticut who they connected me with. There was a national conference where I was able to meet other SIDS moms. And it was so helpful. And that's why, you know, a SIDS death, every death is tragic, but a SIDS death is unlike any other, and you do need to have that support. And that's why at First Candle, we have Facebook support groups for SIDS, for miscarriage, for stillbirth. We have books that we send people. We have a hotline and a grief line for people to call and get services. You can always go to firstcandle.org and find these resources. But, you know, we are that shoulder to cry on, that ear to listen to you, because so often people don't know what to say to somebody who's lost a baby, and it's so difficult. So we're there for them.
Excellent. Well, we're going to come back and talk more with Allison Jacobson, CEO of First Candle. We're going to take a quick break, but let's come back and listen to some of the other important points that she's going to make, including clarifying the difference between SIDS and other sleep-related deaths, and some of the things that First Candle has done to help bring down the rate of sleep-related infant deaths. We'll be back with Allison Jacobson. Stay with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Connecticut Walk and Run for Hope in Fairfield is a 5K family event in support of Cancer Care's free programs and services for Connecticut patients, caregivers, and loved ones impacted by cancer. It's happening at Jennings Beach on October 14th. This special event is an opportunity for businesses and residents alike to show their support for people affected by all cancers, to celebrate survivors, and remember loved ones. To ensure that Cancer Care's services remain free, participants create teams through the event website, set a goal, and reach out to friends, family, and colleagues to raise support. This Connecticut event combines the walk run formerly held in Greenwich at Todd's Point with the Jennings Beach event, and anyone who can't make it can still provide help and hope to individuals and families by making a donation. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about this event, go to community.cancercare.org/Fairfield2018. Well, thanks for staying with us. Allison Jacobson is here. She's CEO of First Candle, a national nonprofit based here in Connecticut that's committed to eliminating SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and other sleep-related infant deaths through education, while also providing support for grieving families who suffered a loss. Allison lost her son, her first son, Connor, to SIDS in 1997, and she's been a passionate advocate for this issue and has become very educated and informed in order to be able to inform folks like you who are listening to our program or podcast this morning. So, Allison, let's talk about the difference between SIDS and other sleep-related infant deaths.
Yeah, so SIDS still is unknown and unpredictable. There's a lot of research being done at Boston Children's Hospital as to what actually is happening, and there is a physiological time. There's a time of development in the baby's brain, and this usually is between 2 to 4 months. Along with SIDS, though, there is other sleep-related infant deaths, and most of that is accidental suffocation. And that is when the baby is not on a flat, firm mattress, but in a soft mattress where the position is a problem. They're not on their back. They may be sleeping on a couch. They may be sleeping in dad's arms. We had a tragic case in New Canaan of a pediatrician many years ago. He was watching Monday Night Football and had his baby on his chest, and the baby died. So unfortunately, there are many, many cases of accidental suffocation. And many of these SIDS cases that were thought to be SIDS in reality were accidental suffocation. The good news is, while SIDS is still unpreventable and unpredictable, these accidental suffocation cases can be completely prevented. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has created safe sleep guidelines to indeed prevent these cases.
Mm. Are certain babies more susceptible to SIDS?
Yes, they are. And again, this has to do with, first of all, preemie babies are more susceptible. Boys are more susceptible. So the reason is there's a serotonin level that babies have, and it's higher in boy babies, which keeps them sleeping more soundly. They are missing that reflex, that jolting to wake up. Mm. So it's almost a misnomer when somebody's saying, oh, is your baby sleeping through the night? A baby's not supposed to be sleeping completely through the night at 2 months old. They are supposed to be waking up. So that's another thing we want to get out there is, what does real good sleep look like for a baby? It's not sleeping completely through the night. It is waking up at certain hours through the night.
Okay. Well, what are some of the things that you and the good folks at First Candle are doing to help bring down the rate of sleep-related infant deaths?
Well, you know, it breaks my heart when I talk to a parent who's lost a baby and I hear, no one ever told me, or I wish I had known about the safe sleep guidelines. So we have created Straight Talk for Infant Safe Sleep. And this is a program we conduct around the country with daycare providers, nurses, social workers, even members of the clergy, anybody who has access to new moms and dads in their own community. And we teach them about the safe sleep guidelines, but not only just teach them, talk about the whys behind them. And the most important ones, and we have a tagline now, room share, not bed share, and keep it bare, meaning that babies should be in their own sleep environment in mom and dad's room for the first year of life, on a firm mattress with a tight-fitting sheet and nothing else in that crib. No blankets, no stuffed animals, no pillows, no fluffy bumpers. And we are talking to these care providers in the community about these guidelines, and then also kind of brainstorming with them and troubleshooting about what are the objections, what are the challenges parents might have in adhering to these guidelines so that we can help them. I mean, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of parents out there who have housing challenges, and they may be sleeping on somebody's couch. We talk about that. We talk about teen moms. We talk about cultures where they do believe in sharing a family bed, and we talk about different ways of making that look where it's still safe. So in our Straight Talk for Infant Safe Sleep, we're talking to many communities around the Connecticut area and nationwide about how we can adopt these safe sleep guidelines and keep these babies alive, because still every year over 3,500 babies die of SIDS and accidental sleep suffocation.
Mm. And certainly, Allison, you bring deep empathy to the situation as CEO of First Candle, but your organization also doesn't only serve to help prevent with the recognition of so many children lost. You also are an important component to families who are working to grapple with a sleep-related death or SIDS incident with a child of their own or a loved one. Let's talk a little bit about what you offer to the survivors.
Well, you know, one of the most important things is there's a tremendous amount of guilt for parents who have lost their baby to SIDS or accidental suffocation, and they're grieving. And every day I read stories and hear stories from parents. So at First Candle, we have Facebook support groups for stillbirth and miscarriage and SIDS. We have a grief support hotline, which is 1-800-221-SIDS. That people can call. We have bereavement support materials that we send out to people, and all of this is available on our website, firstcandle.org, because it's so important to not only support the parents, but the grandparents, the caregivers. So many people are impacted by the death of a child. As you said, I lost my son Connor in 1997 at daycare. When I got to the hospital, the daycare providers were devastated. There were police officers, EMTs who were crying in the emergency room, the pediatricians. So this is something that has a lasting impact on so many people, and we offer bereavement support services to all of them.
That's great. There's also an opportunity for people to memorialize the child they lost through a First Candle.
Exactly. You can go to our site. You can set up a memorial, especially on Facebook now. People are donating proceeds from their birthday in lieu of gifts they're being asked to give to First Candle, because our name, firstcandle.org, is our hope of getting every baby to their first birthday. So many families for a baby's first birthday are celebrating by donating money to First Candle in honor of a baby or their subsequent child known as a rainbow baby, which is very important.
Very good. Before we let you go, Allison, for folks that maybe have just tuned in, if you can cover once again the web resources and just recap the most critical information that people need to know when they are in when they are taking care of a newborn, if they are in a daycare situation, if they are the parents themselves, just give us another quick 60-second recap and how they can learn more about First Candle.
Absolutely. The biggest thing is room share, not bed share, and keep it bare. A separate bassinet or crib in mom and dad's room with a firm mattress and a tight-fitting sheet and nothing else. And that's for every sleep, not just bedtime, but nap time. And we have a whole host of resources on our site, firstcandle.org.
First Candle is based here in Connecticut. Allison Jacobson, who lost her son Connor to SIDS in 1997, is CEO. We really appreciate making your acquaintance, Allison. Very great and informative chat this morning, and I dare say we're going to be seeing a lot of hallways outside of parents' bedrooms full of bumpers and blankets and stuffed animals getting relocated to a safer and better place as a result of folks listening to this spot. So thank you very, very much for your advocacy. Again, our condolences on your loss and our gratitude for all the great information you gave us this morning. We appreciate all the work that First Candle is doing, and we will hopefully talk to you again soon. Thank you so much. Well, it's great to rejoin with old friends here on the award-winning For the People. So as we wrap up our last program of September. We're going to look toward October and a very important event that you've heard about on this program for years. It is the Walk to End Lupus Now, which is happening this year on October 14th at the beautiful Calf Pasture Beach in Norwalk. We're so pleased to welcome back a good friend here on the award-winning For the People, Colleen Han. She's a volunteer and a committee member for the Walk to End Lupus Now here in Connecticut. Colleen, thanks for joining us here on the program once again. Appreciate you calling in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, first of all, before we get into the background information, just remind folks about your personal story and what gave you direction to choose this cause of all the ones that you could be involved with.
Absolutely. I was diagnosed with lupus in 2010. In my situation, I had a lot of infections, a lot of inflammation and joint pain. And then, you know, I went to see a lot of rheumatologists. And basically, you know, after a while, I was basically just trying to deal with the infections and what I had to work through. And they finally got me to a great rheumatologist in New York City, and I've been working with her ever since. And that was because I work with the Lupus Foundation of America as a volunteer, and I was able to make connections through that group.
I know we talked on previous occasions about this great media and billboard campaign about putting a face on lupus, but I think a lot of people still are either a little bit in the dark or have no real foundational knowledge of what lupus is. Can you walk us through that?
Absolutely. Lupus is a chronic autoimmune disease. It is an immune system that is basically out of balance. So it causes it to become destructive to any tissue or organ in the body, like the skin and the joints, the heart, the lung, the kidneys, and the brain. And it strikes without warning, and it affects everybody differently. I know in my case, it could sometimes be something that I ate. Stress is definitely a factor, outside environmental factors as well. So you never know how it's going to affect anybody. Not one person with lupus is affected the same way.
So this must make it very, very challenging for organizations like the Lupus Foundation of America, who work so hard to not only address and support individuals and families around the country that are dealing with lupus, but at the same time try to split their resources and their energies toward research and finding a cure. Let's talk a little bit about how you discovered the Lupus Foundation of America and why you become such a passionate advocate for the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I actually found them online, and then I started talking to one of the coordinators who is no longer part of the organization anymore, but she moved to a different location. I worked with them, and I met her, and then I started attending the events, and that, actually that was in New York City. And then they expanded the walk to the suburbs about last year. And so it's been a great opportunity for me to be able to get out there and meet a whole bunch of new people who are facing the same issues that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a wonderful experience overall, learning what the different works for some people and what doesn't work, and then trying to find a balance between it, everything.
Mm. From your perspective, are you keeping an eye on the research and advocacy end of things, at least for your own knowledge?
Yes, actually I think it was 2 years ago, I even went down to Washington, D.C. They have a two-day summit where we go to Congress and we speak about our situation and being able to get funding for lupus. So we were able to get money from the CDC and the Department of Defense, which was fantastic. And I don't remember the exact amounts that they gave us, but it was quite a bit of money working towards research, education, and advocacy.
Mm. Well, I know a few minutes ago you said that for you, triggers could be stress, something you ate, situations you're in, or even environmental stimulus. I mean, that's pretty much across the board in terms of what causes or triggers the symptoms of lupus in you. Are there other symptoms or other situations beyond these three that impact you that can set off symptoms in other individuals that you know?
It's possible. accessible. There's lots of different types of lupus. In my case, I have what's called SLE. It's systemic. So that is my form of lupus. There's other people that have lupus nephritis, and that attacks the kidneys more. So it depends on the situation, and the doctor is actually trying to figure out the best way to attack that issue and solve it so it fits, you know, the health of that person, and they can heal better.
In your situation, do different symptoms surface depending on whether the stimulus is stress, something you ate, or an environmental contact?
Yes, for sure. I definitely notice I get rashes quite often on my legs, on my arms. I have a butterfly rash on my face. And actually, when I eat a plant-based diet, which I've been doing lately, it seems to be minimizing the rash on my face. I'm not sure why, but that seems to be what's been helping me the best.
Are there any other things that you could do, or supplements, or nutritional intake that you can...
I actually went on a Weight Watchers program, and I have been doing it since April. I've lost about 20 pounds and been walking about 4 miles a day. That has helped tremendously. But, you know, again, if there are other factors that play in, like stress from, you know, work or anything else,
life,
then it's kind of hard to balance it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, when did you immediately get involved with the Lupus Foundation of America or the Walk to End Lupus Now, immediately after you learned that you had lupus, or was this something that you...
Yes, oh, okay. Yeah, I did. And then that first walk, I actually raised about $3,000.
Fantastic. So let folks know a little bit of the detail of this event that's coming up on October 14th. This is a pretty big deal because it's the only one in Connecticut and one of the only ones in the region, with the next one probably not happening until next spring, and that's in New York City.
Right, yeah. The walk is going to start at 2 p.m. with check-in, and it's a three-mile walk around the beach, and it's a great event for family and friends to come and help raise awareness for lupus.
What are some of the other activities or educational opportunities that people can enjoy when they come and kind of get an idea of the critical mass of people that are either supporting a loved one with lupus or, like yourself, an individual diagnosed with it?
Well, they have a lot of information at the tents at the event, and they will have research provided for you so that you can look up information not needed. There's also an informational website that they have at www.lupus.org, and it provides a lot of information about lupus as well, and they even have a toll-free number on there that you can call, 1-800-558-0121, to obtain free information about lupus. So that will all be at the event. They usually have activities for children, and, you know, the different, they have a shaded tent for people who have issues with the sun, and there will be plenty of people there from the organization that will be there to help you.
So from an informational standpoint, does lupus pretty much affect anybody at any time in their life, or are there particular times in life when lupus develops? Is it more predisposed to happening in any particular ethnic groups or anything like that?
Well, they say that most of the people that are affected are Latina and Native American women, as well as African American and Asian. And it affects people between the ages of 15 and 44. However, there are some people that have it younger and some people that have it older.
Okay. More predominantly with males or females?
More predominantly with females. But I do know a few males that have it as well.
So let's talk a little bit about the opportunity that you've had. I mean, it sounds like you've really... jumped into this to get as much of a comprehensive understanding of what's going on in your own body as you can, as well as becoming familiar with the research and advocacy that the Lupus Foundation of America is doing. But let's talk about the importance of people with lupus networking and interacting with others that have it. It's not just about meeting researchers and talking to authorities. There's probably a lot to learn, right, when you're interacting with other people that are living with lupus?
Yes, absolutely. That's why I'm also an ambassador for the lupus program. So we meet every couple of months or so, and we go out to the communities and we reach out. I just did an event this summer with the Girl Scouts of America in New Rochelle, and we talk to people about what they're going through. And this way we can build a network and get ideas what other people are going through, not just with what I have, but also can find out what works for them, what doesn't work for them. Maybe you need to change something that you're doing, and it's a good outlet for emotional support as well.
And I have to imagine with the explosion of social network resources, there's a lot more means to be able to connect with people than just going to lupus.org and getting the facts and the basic background information from the Lupus Foundation of America. Are you engaged in any kind of social network groups or other types of meetings or outreach activities?
I don't work with any other organizations that support lupus, per se, but I do my own research online, and I use the national resource websites provided from the foundation, and I also go on Facebook, and I actually do, I'm actually part of some organizations on Facebook as well.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you for reaching out again, as you have in the past, to help refresh my mind and hopefully the minds of a lot of folks that are listening about lupus, which really impacts 1.5 million people in America and thousands here in Connecticut. If folks want to learn more, obviously we just said they can go to lupus.org. If they know somebody with lupus or they themselves have faced a diagnosis, there are a lot of resources available, but most importantly, the best way to learn about it and show solidarity and support the work and the outreach that the Lupus Foundation of America does, as well as its research and governmental advocacy. We want everybody to come on out to the Connecticut Walk. The Walk to End Lupus Now is happening October 14th at Calf Pasture Beach in Norwalk. Registration and check-in begin at 2, and the 3-mile walk begins at 3 p.m. Colleen Hand, thank you so much once again for reaching out to us and educating us about lupus here as we move into October. We hope folks come out on October 14th to this important event. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.